refinance activity is heating up. Are your originators ready to capture the opportunity? Join Optimal Blue experts Jared Sammy and Brennan O'Connell on October 7th at 1 p.m. Central for a live webinar. Refi Revival, stay ahead of the curve with Originator Intelligence. You'll discover how to surface high-potential refinance leads from your closed loan data, reconnect with past borrowers using timely data-driven outreach, and cut research time from 30 minutes to just one click. Register now with the link in the show notes for this episode to give your team the edge in quarter four and beyond. In case you missed it, Optimal Blue has announced the dates for its 2026 summit. Join us February 23rd to 25th at Talking Stick Resort and Conference Center in Scottsdale, Arizona, for a client-exclusive event packed with strategic insight and innovation. Attendees will gain early access to Optimal Blue's latest generative AI and automation tools, dive into expert-led sessions on pricing, compliance, and more, and experience hands-on demos of new capabilities. Plus, it's a chance to connect with capital markets pros, integration partners, and mortgage insiders, all while gaining actionable strategies to maximize profitability and sharpen your competitive edge. The Optimal Blue Summit, where proven mortgage expertise meets modern innovation to shape what's next. Early bird registration is now open at summit.optimalblue.com. Space is limited, so register today.
Welcome to Market Advantage, the monthly podcast from Optimal Blue. Tune in for valuable insights from the Market Advantage Mortgage Data Report and in-depth conversations with industry experts. Stay competitive and optimize your advantage in the ever-evolving mortgage landscape.
Welcome to this month's episode of the Market Advantage podcast. We're going to kick off with data highlights from July, and then we'll sit down with this month's guest. We have Julian Hebron of the Basis Point joining us. Now we are back to full data representation at Optimal Blue. We have Mike Vogue here again this month, and back from maternity leave, we have Brennan O'Connell. Great to see you both.
Hey, Olivia. Good to be back. A little sleepier than I was pre-paternity leave, but here we are.
Happy to have you. So tell us, what kind of data did we see in July?
Yeah, let's get right into it. So rate lock volumes in July were down 3% month over month. We saw a nearly 5% decline in purchase activity. It was somewhat offset by 5 and 7% increases, maybe unsuspected increases in cash out and rate term refinances, respectively. So that purchase volume, though, doubling down here, despite the decline, we're effectively flat on a year-over-year basis. Mike and I were talking before we started the recording here. It's sort of like the election results are in, or it's late enough in the night that we have enough data about purchase activity in 2025 to say that it looks like we're going to be about the same as we were last year here as we near the end of the peak buying season. So I guess things didn't get worse. A lot of folks were hoping it would get better, and unfortunately, we just did not see it. I think until we see more material rate relief, we're going to be in a bit of a subdued buyer market.
Can we finally put an end to the survive till 25 mantra now? We could like finally bury that one, I think. You know, despite like the ho-hum like numbers, you know, I don't think the floor is falling out here. You know, we've heard, at least I've heard some of the news media that I follow that, you know, there is certain geographic areas that are seeing some serious price depreciation. Mostly those towns that are or were classified as like a COVID boom town. You think of like Florida, Texas, Tennessee, you know, cities like Nashville. But in general, when we look at the data, we don't really see the average amount of loan size changing that much. That corresponds with some large price decrease. And, you know, it typically has been fluctuating like up or down $2,000 or $3,000 a month. I think we were down maybe like $4,000 this month in terms of average purchase size, and that average loan size is somewhere in that 380-ish range. So we're not really seeing any pressure there, but everyone who banked on 25 being that super bounce back year might need to start making some new plans for the rest of the year.
Agreed. Yeah, the real difficult stories seem to be contained to certain specific geographies, and nationally we're just seeing more of a subdued, maybe slightly disappointing, but not highly dangerous types of markets here. Going forward here, it does seem like we're going to get a little bit of some tailwinds on the refi side, maybe not materially, but you've got this larger base of folks who've originated or taken out loans in the last 2 to 3 years in a higher rate environment. So year over year, we were basically sitting in the same rate environment, but you saw 5 to 10% growth in the total refi volume. So I do think that is going to continue, where the sort of lock-in dynamic where everybody was sitting at a 3%, over time, those loans, people move and, people have to sell their homes for whatever reason and take out a new mortgage at a higher rate. And so there is, I think, a growing pocket and a growing opportunity for originators for refinances. And so you're seeing a more sensitive market to even small rate drops, which we saw at the beginning of this month, despite finishing up, which brings me to my next point here. We are up 5 bips from the end of June to the end of July. Our 30-year conforming index, the OB30C benchmark, was up to 6.72% to finish the month. FHA rates rose 3 bips to 6.5. VA rates ticked up 4 bips to about 6 1/3, it was 6.33, and jumbo rates were up about an eighth to 6.89%. So rates up across the board, but despite that, we still saw refi activity pick up. I do want to mention, as we're talking about rates here, that we're continuing to see growth, and maybe in some places, Mike, that you can talk about that we weren't expecting, with the CME mortgage rate future, which is based on that OB30C I mentioned earlier.
Yeah, I think the initial kind of theory that we really wanted to solve for with the mortgage rate future was hedging for a mortgage servicing right valuations. So typically, the MSR portfolio is the largest asset on a mortgage bank's balance sheet, and it's those the right to those future cash flows to servicing the loan. So as rates go down, right, you expect more prepayments. And that actually decreases the value of your mortgage servicing rights portfolio. And there wasn't really a natural hedge out there or a direct hedge for moves in mortgage servicing right valuations. You might think you could use different swaps or treasuries or even TBA. But if you use any of those instruments, you have a gap there. And if you use the TBA, for example, you'd have a gap on the primary secondary spread, which is the difference between TBAs and the retail rate that you see published out there. OBMI captures that quote-unquote retail rate that's published out there. So we believe that difference there in that primary-secondary spread was a big problem for folks who are hedging that servicing right. And so we partnered with the CME to actually bring that future to market. And we started to see some folks start to use that as a part of their risk mitigation strategy if you're in charge of the risk of your MSR portfolio. Another interesting development, though, that we've seen over the past 45 to 60 days or so, are folks who are in that non-agency sector. You have a large exposure to maybe jumbo loans or non-QM loans, have actually started to dip their toe in the water of using that mortgage rate future as a hedge. It's kind of similar to MSR, right? There's not that deep liquid secondary market of like a security that you could deliver a non-agency loan into, the same way that there's not some deep liquid, a natural hedge out there for MSR. But both of these assets are exposed to prepayment risk, right? And if you could at least account for that component, you could have a hedge strategy that works out really well. Now, there's a whole different credit component that we have to work with to talk about on the non-agency side, but we're starting to see, some folks as non-agency loans get more and more adoption and they take up a more of a percent share of originations, that folks are starting to dip their toes in the water from a hedging standpoint. And the mortgage rate future based off of our RC30 rate has been maybe not one that we've seen actually executed yet, but we're seeing a lot of folks testing it out as a strategy to mitigate that risk there.
Yeah, optimistic on that front, certainly. And it seems as though there's going to be plenty of opportunity to hedge non-agency loans. This is, we're talking about the growth there. In July, we were up to 8%. And this is within our rate lock data. We actually have some other data set. So if I look at just our kind of like wholesale data, non-agency is up to nearly 20% of all volume. And so that's sort of the broker channel. And so that's just a subset. But you've got this secular trend towards growing non-agency volume, particularly in the non-QM space, in addition to prime jumbo. And as I mentioned, we're up to 8%. That was the first time that we've hit 8. It's the highest figure since we've been tracking non-QM as a, its own standalone product line in our data here. You know, it's interesting, and Mike, maybe you could dive into this. I know you've talked about it on a couple of other podcasts recently, but the non-QM umbrella is really describing a few different types of loans. For example, here within just our data set, we look at the investor DSCR category, which made up 29% of non-QM lending. Bank statement loans, you know, really driven by a lot of the gig economy, is at 34%. And then sort of like the all other non-QM bucket at 38%. So it'd be great if you could talk a little bit more about what's driving this secular trend towards non-QM lending.
Absolutely. The main thing that kind of separates a QM loan from a non-QM loan, it just comes down to debt, the amount of debt that a specific borrower has, and the verification of the income. So you think of like a QM loan, it's typically you're a W-2 employee, right? There's odds and ends there. You can get a QM mortgage without a W-2, but in general, you need a W-2. So if you look at like, and then also for a QM mortgage, you can't have a DTI or a debt to income ratio above a 43. So when you then pivot to these other types of borrowers, maybe folks who have four or five different properties that they're looking at, they're an entrepreneur and they have a lot of debt, right? You may classify as somebody who would be better served as a non-QM borrower. Potentially, maybe you have your own business, right? And you don't have a W-2 per se, but you have plenty enough of assets in the bank. You might need a bank statement loan. And we've seen just some, to your point about gig economy, you know, you've seen people who have really jumped headfirst into, you know, owning multiple Airbnb properties, maybe folks who are, you know, driving for DoorDash, doing Ubers, kind of piecing together the gig economy there. And you also have, I think, a lot of folks who are looking at different ways to be entrepreneurs as well. And so you have all these things kind of coalescing around each other to really push the non-QM, you know, volume up. And I would also say, and I'm going to credit you for this stat, Brennan, we were looking at some of the search data in our wholesale PPE loan sifter. And, you know, you mentioned 8% non-QM from origination standpoint, but we see almost 15, 16% of the search volume within loan sifter targeted at that, you know, that non-QM loan. And what that really tells me is that the brokers are taking a very consultative approach of trying to fit the needs of specific borrowers. And anytime you get out of that cookie cutter, greater than 43 DTI and non W-2 employee, you kind of find yourself into that non-QM range. And so just as long as we see, you know, some of those kind of changes in the populace from a work perspective, yeah, I think we will continue to see elevated volumes here.
Yeah, that broker and non-QM, the Venn diagram is pretty big between the two of them, and sort of self-reinforcing, right? As we see growth in wholesale and non-agency lending. We're at the nearing the end of this segment, and I know we got our guest coming on, but we want to do our stat of the month. We'll see if this keeps going as a routine here. But mine to kick us off here is that the planned unit development volume, so we have PUD volume in our data set, which is a really good proxy for new construction. It was up 0.85%. Of total market share to 28.5% of all market, primarily at the expense of single family properties, which dropped down. Single family properties are still accounting for over 60%. But the real stat is that at the same time last year, that PUD volume, again, a really good proxy for new construction, was nearly 4 percentage points higher than it is today. And so what I think it's telling us is that the very aggressive builder activity that we saw 22, 23, 24, things have slowed on the builder side, and you're seeing it in the data. Less of the purchase lending is going towards new construction, and that's certainly reflective of what's going on in the builder community.
Yeah, I'm gonna jump in with Mike's stat of the month. You know, the biggest kind of stat that I saw that was interesting was we saw the percentage of loans sold to the agency cash window drop almost 2 points over the month of July. So the previous month, it was 28% of loans were actually sold to the agency cash window compared to 26% in July. Now, this kind of evened out though with the share of loans that were securitized into an agency mortgage-backed security going up 2% during that same period of time, going from 35 to 37%. Now, folks might say, okay, well, the agencies are getting both loans, like who cares? But it does tell you a little bit about the type of people who are selling loans. Typically, the folks who are creating these mortgage-backed securities are either banks or they're the larger IMBs. So what I think might be happening there is that you might be seeing some market share kind of move towards the larger players out there and maybe some regional banks, as opposed to, you know, your independent mortgage bank, which is selling primarily to the agency cash window or to, larger aggregators. And I think that's an interesting stat for us to kind of watch here to next month, see if that trend holds up.
Thanks, guys. Okay, let's welcome this month's guest. We have Julian Hebron, founder of The Basis Point, joining us. Julian, welcome to the Market Advantage.
Thanks so much, Olivia. So glad to be here joining you and Mike today.
Now, to our audience, if you've spent any time at all on the mortgage or real estate conference circuit, you've definitely heard Julian speak. You've seen him moderate sessions. I know I speak on behalf of the Optimal Blue team when I say we really enjoy participating in the tech showcases that you moderate, Julian, not only because you have such an extensive understanding of the tech that drives our industry, but because you ask real questions that really push participants to give substantive answers versus just, you know, the surface level talking points. And we'll actually be doing a little bit of that later today. Julian, you were going to do a little bit of a reverse interview with Mike Vogue here. So looking forward to that. But before we dive into that, I would like to start with a little bit about the Basis Point and the work that you're doing there, Julian. So I think a good starting point would be your thoughts on the rate outlook.
Sure. Yeah. The Basis Point's rate outlook is part observation of what we believe are the most astute forecasts out there, and part bringing our own sensibilities into it. And one thing that we've noticed, so if you look at MBA's most recent forecast at 6.7 by year end, we were converged between them and Fannie for a little while. Right now, Fannie in their most recent forecast is 6.4. So you've got year end 25 at 6.7, MBA 6.4, Fannie, and then 6.4 year end 26 MBA versus 6% Fannie. So we are a little more aligned with Fannie's lower forecasts at this time. They had converged for a while, now they're diverging again. Fannie's taking a little bit more of an aggressive stance. The reason we're more closely aligned with that is because the low sixes are possible even this year in our view. Remember, rates dropped to 6 1/8 ahead of last September's Fed cut. Then they rose right after that back up to the sevens and higher as markets felt at first that both presidential candidates and then the current president had inflationary policies. This morning, we're recording this, of course, late July, early August, and Treasury Secretary Bessent said they expect to know Jay Powell's successor by year end this year. Likewise, if inflation doesn't spike between now and then, the Powell Fed may also cut. So late 4Q 2025 and 1Q 2026, the bond market's going to start pricing this stuff in our view. And it's going to happen, I think, more aggressively than maybe either of these MBA or Fannie forecasts. And I also think that rates are going to price in dovishness before the 2Q26 May Fed leadership change. And one last element that I'm going to add, if you are going for a more dovish Fed chair, QE, even though I don't think it's necessary at all, is still a possibility. Just because of this pressure that a new Fed chair may get. And if you combine all of those things, I think that we're going to have rates that are lower than any of the projections that are currently published by the major players. I'm curious to know, of course, what, you know, rate leader Optimal Blue thinks on that, if they align or don't align.
I think everyone would be excited with a low six, high five handle. I think that would spurn a lot of growth from an origination standpoint. You know, it's interesting, like our index OBMMI came in about 6.73 last night. And so that's based upon the lock data that we see on a daily basis. And we actually have tradable futures based off that data as well now. You know, I think there would be a lot of refi opportunity and new production in general from a purchase standpoint opportunity at that six range. We had a Fed meeting recently as well where we actually had two dissents for the first time in a while. We haven't had a non unanimous decision in quite a couple years. So I think that some of the tea leaves are there to go lower. I still am a little concerned about the inflation numbers. I think we would have to see some unemployment rate uptick to really get a push down of materiality. So like that's something I'm definitely keeping an eye on there is like, hey, like are we seeing enough unemployment increases to counter any type of like inflation stagnation? Because I still think inflation is a little bit higher than what folks would like it to be. And we may have not seen full impact of tariffs yet. So those are some things that we're keeping an eye on here. But interesting times from a rate perspective, especially if you throw in the idea of a new Fed chair taking over. There's certainly a lot of pressure on the current Fed chair and a new Fed chair to lower rates. But I still think the component part of the affordability problem, but it's not the whole thing. And then your point on QE is really interesting. You know, from a spread perspective, there is still a fair bit amount of spread between where you would see the mortgage-backed security rates and like treasuries or SOFR right now. I actually was able to pull up a little bit of data while we were chatting. And like when there is like QE, you usually see that spread somewhere in that 1.2, 1.3 range from a rate perspective. And we're closer to 2 right now. So that's almost like 75 basis points to maybe a half point of like extra slack there from a rate perspective, that if the Fed starts buying, you could see that type of like impact on mortgage rates. That's counter to them lowering the Fed funds rate.
Yes. And the reason I bring that up is twofold. One, it's purely based on the extreme political pressure that is coming, not just to go from a 4.5% Fed funds rate to a 1% Fed funds rate. That is the call from the president, which I think all the smart money in the bond market understands that to do that would imply a crisis, and there is no crisis, you know, as it pertains to the Fed's management of the dual mandate. But the political pressure is very real. And then Jeff Gundlach, who I like to follow very closely just because, you know, being the modern bond king, that's something that he's been super vocal about, that he believes that a dovish new appointment to replace Fed Chair Powell would in fact maybe have a high probability of bringing in QE. So that's what informs that comment.
I think it's a spot on comment. I think Jeff is really, really smart. He's a great guy to kind of follow and you know, read his commentary on things. That's the only way to kind of keep some of the potential inflationary aspects of that under, like in play of like, hey, maybe there's no minimal rate decrease, but the Fed is out there buying rates from that perspective.
That's the interesting X factor that's underreported. And I just want to point out just two more quick notes on this topic that I think are really important, especially with how loud the pressure is. But let's not forget a couple of things. If QE came in, if it was, to your point, if it was QE as a different lever to pull other than Fed funds rate decreases, that might play. But if it was both, like, you know, let's cut to 1% and let's also do QE, let's make no mistake, it would be wonderful for the mortgage industry, but it would be a sugar high and we would pay the price later. So I just would like to say to all your listeners, let's be, you know, deliberate about what we wish for. We are going to get our rate declines and we are going to have a great run in this business late 25 and for sure in 26, but we don't need all of it. And the sugar high aftermath is going to be a problem for us if it went that way. And then critically, point number two, home prices will rise. Everybody forgets with all this other noise out there about how wrong the Fed chair is. Everybody forgets this is the Fed's intent to slow down the appreciation of homes, right? It's good for buyers and it does not hurt owners after they had a 40% run during the pandemic. So that's our view, is like, we all want this. As an industry, we are going to get our low rate run, but you don't want it to be so extreme that home prices just spike and the affordability issue is even worse.
Yeah, because we're not addressing anything from a supply standpoint with any of these policies that we're talking about. It is strictly exactly. a single lever being pulled, and it could exacerbate a lot of the problems that the economy is seeing there. But and to your point as well, like the economy is doing fairly fine. You know, there has been a slight uptick in delinquencies, and especially some of the government backed products.
That's like
FHA and VA loans.
Yep.
Still relatively low in the grand scheme of things, but an uptick nonetheless. Things are still pretty good. Like there's a couple of little troubling signs from like a consumer standpoint. But if you look at tappable equity out there in the mortgage market, the American homeowner is in a very strong position. So to your point from earlier, there's not really a crisis looming here outside of the affordability one. I think we should be careful about what we wish for, to your point. And, you know, there's other levers that we could pull from a supply standpoint that maybe in conjunction with some soft buying of MBS and then also some rate decrease. It's probably a mix of the three of them to get to a more optimal kind of like level ground for the mortgage industry, in my opinion.
Yeah, agree. And I'll just add some stats for those who don't follow it, Mike, as closely as you and I do to close this one out. But, you know, ICE stats, right? 1.6% home price growth year over year through May. That was 3.5% in January. It's now, as of June, which is the latest data, down to 1.3%. So again, the idea of the Fed holding rates higher is keeping a lid on runaway appreciation. More than 25% of the largest markets are seeing home prices below last year's levels, and 30% of markets seeing price declines of 1% plus from the peaks, and then declines of more than 3% in places like Texas, Florida, California, Arizona, Colorado, Idaho, but again, those were where you had 40+% pandemic appreciation runs. So if you're coming down 3%, so be it. It helps today's buyers without jamming up today's owners.
So let's segue into lending trends. So we had a call with you a few weeks ago, Julian, where you and Mike bantered for a while on some different trends that have been hot lately. So Mike's favorite topic, non-QM, non-agency prime, HELOC, bridge loans. Are these hot just because of the market we're in, or is this indicating more of a fundamental shift?
The credit box always expands when cycles get longer. So the direct answer to your question is these areas have been doing well, partly because we're long in the cycle and partly because they are permanent components. These four things we identified that you just mentioned, they are permanent and needed components of the credit box, right? And so I can address all four of them pretty quickly. Non-QM will always, through full market cycles, help tougher borrower scenarios and help put more people in homes. And it's getting better all the time. Technology helps make the underwriting better, direct-to-source data, less fraud. Because again, when you're underwriting, say on assets more than income, as an example, like you really have to have the data. And so non-QM is definitely as good, as astute as it's ever been, because the underwriting quality is great. And that's a needed area. Another needed area is non-agency prime. Very simply though, that in our view, I've spent most of my career in the mortgage industry, and especially as an originator in the non-agency prime space. And it's dominated by balance sheet banks. So non-banks have a play, but in the end, that's a sophisticated consumer. They know where the lowest rates are, and the balance sheet institutions have the lowest cost of funds. They don't have secondary costs, and so they're going to continue to dominate that area. HELOC, it's super important, especially as Mike said, with record tappable equity. Definitely profitable, especially for the firms that are saying, hey, we're going to charge a little bit of a margin premium there for the speed and not do it like, say, the balance sheet institutions where we're going to require full appraisal. It's going to take 40 plus days. The firms that are doing it in days, like a few days rather than a month and a half, 2 months, do charge a premium margin there. But there's going to be an interesting moment where we're going to have, I think, a sales spike, because as Fed funds comes down, Fed funds plus 3 is prime. Prime is the base rate for all HELOCs. And so as that prime rate comes down, as Fed funds comes down, it's going to provide some sales motivation for the HELOC sellers out there to say, hey, this is cheaper for you now. Maybe you want to put it in place because you have all this equity. That's then directly related to, that can be another form of the fourth one, which is bridge loans. And we really think that bridge loans are an underrated and actually misunderstood niche, because in short, the cool thing about a bridge loan is that if you're an institution that will do bridge loans, your prerequisite is that you have to do the new purchase loan. So doing bridge loans is meant not so much to make money off bridge loans, it's meant to drive your purchase business. So I think all four of these stick around through full market cycles, but in the end, the bell curve of all production in our industry is still always going to be primarily agency business. And that stuff is going to increase, as we just discussed, as rates come down. But these four areas are all critically important, but I would go so far as to say they're all niches.
Yeah, I totally agree with the overall trend spotting there. On the bridge and the HELOC front, I mentioned record equity earlier. It's a big number. Like the U.S. housing stock is valued at approximately $48 trillion, and there's like $14 trillion of mortgages against it. So you're talking like $35-ish trillion of tappable equity out there. And so I think HELOC and bridge loans are going to have a longer tail here than maybe like normal cycles because of that fact, and because of just how much home appreciation has happened in the last 5 years, and then the demographics of the country right now, with most homeowners being, you know, skewed towards the older ages. So I think that's going to be there for a while. I recently bought a new house and used a bridge loan, and it was a fantastic experience. It helped me kind of structure the deal in a way where I was able to avoid some, you know, capital gain stuff and other assets that I had. So it was a really nice feature that my loan officer that set me up with, and it was a very creative solution. You know, the non-agency, you know, sector, I've been out there publicly talking about this for a while, but there are some interesting things I think that are changing. You know, I think as of right now, as of when we record this podcast, you know, there's been a little bit of, they're going to go and be spun off and be non-government entities, whipsaw with the agencies. It was, they're going. A little bit of talking it back recently, and, you know, their stock price has referred that, where that's come back down a little bit. Still up high. So I think a lot of the betting money is still on them being released in some way or another. But I believe if that happens, there will be a little bit more staying power for the non-agency products, just because, you know, the whole, like, you know, more profit focused versus mission focused, if they're not completely a government agency at that moment in time. And then you also think there have been some demographic changes. Think about folks who are now doing more gig economy things. Think about folks who are, maybe they bought an Airbnb property during the pandemic, and now they're on property 3 or 4. These DSCR loans are a really interesting fit for people who are like that. So I think there's a little bit more staying power there. And then an interesting stat that I just kind of figured out recently is, you know, on our data side, we see somewhere in that like 8 to 9% range of loans in the non-QM space. But if you look at the broker channel, it's almost 16 or 17%. Of what we see from broker searches in our Loan Sifter platform. So it seems like they're taking a little bit more of a consultative approach to looking at the different eligibility guidelines across the products, as they're not nearly as ubiquitous as agency loans. And they're using that in almost like concierge servicing, like potential borrowers who are in these interesting niches that weren't a slam dunk W-2 employee for an agency loan.
And credit where credit is due, I agree completely. Brokers represent, like retail shops, but brokers especially are those boots on the ground that really know this, and they are willing to work the tougher profiles. Tougher profiles doesn't mean necessarily first timers, credit challenged. It does mean that, but it also means very sophisticated, independent investors, people with multiple sources of income, tax returns that vary year over year. And brokers have dominated that space because they're willing to put in the work.
Yeah, it's not always credit, right? Like, one of the things I say about this non-agency sector is it's really just income verification, right? Like, it's different ways of getting your income verified, whether it's like the rental property aspect from like an economic DSCR angle, or it's, hey, I've sold a business and I don't have a W-2, but I have a bunch of money in the bank, and I can show you bank statements for the last year, right? So to your point, it's, again, not always credit impaired individuals. It could be successful entrepreneurs who just don't fit that box of an agency loan.
Yeah. And one thing I talk about with the loan officer community quite a bit is these clients are super appreciative too. Oftentimes borrowers with perfect profiles are, they view lenders as a commodity and they're less appreciative and they're less relationship driven. So, you know, when you perform for those non-QM customers, man, they come back, they send all their friends who are entrepreneurs who have tough profiles too. So it's great business for those that want to do the tougher deals.
Let's turn gears here. One trend we've heard a lot about throughout 2025 has been this concept of one-stop shop home ownership. Julian, what is the basis points take on this? How complicated is this to actually execute on? And what would success look like for lenders and consumers?
Yeah, and I think I'll do this one quickly because there's been so much on it, but I'll do consumer perspective, lender perspective, and big ideas, right? Consumer perspective, is it actually easier? Do they truly trust one-stop shop? Or is it like, well, hey, like I'm fine using my realtor over here and my lender over here, and I'll go with whichever, you know, title company they choose and this kind of thing, because consumers often don't know that. But I do think big brands, including, of course, Rocket Cooper Redfin is one of the big ones. Of course, Bayview Guild is another one of the big ones that has happened this year. But when you're talking about a brand like Rocket, where they can spend the money to become a household brand and get that consumer trust, I think you'll get it there. The lender perspective is there's just two goals, and it's very simple. Better purchase conversion and servicer retention. Those are kind of the things. And when you think about that, what are the big ideas that the basis point has been mulling? Is this, does a lender have to make all the money in originations, all the money in servicing, and all the money in the real estate transaction? Our working thesis is a truly revolutionary model that brings together the lender and the consumer perspectives, and needless to say, makes it easier and builds trust and lowers costs for consumers, would be to say, what if in the case of a shop that has origination, servicing, and real estate under one roof, what if real estate was viewed purely as customer acquisition and you don't have to make 6% off of that? You can make 1%. And the whole point of it is just to get the customer and say to all your existing servicing portfolio customers, when you're ready, use our search and use our agents to find your new place. And by the way, if you do, you get like a profound discount relative to every other real estate broker in the market. That to me is the big idea. We'll see if institutions that are executing on this go that route. But if you're already dominating originations and servicing, maybe the third leg of that stool isn't about profit, it's about customer experience and lowering costs. That's our big idea for that one.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. I think you're seeing you always have like a two-legged stool, I think, in the mortgage lending world of like originations and servicing. And I think you're slowly seeing that like third leg of the stool come in with real estate. I think it'll be interesting to see if, you know, outside of an actual company like a Rocket Cooper, Redfin, I don't think we've necessarily seen on the tech side that same type of consolidation just yet. I know a lot of folks are talking about that from areas that we've been exploring and looking at as well. But it'll be super interesting to see how that develops. And then also like this whole concept of, you know, the real estate agent and the loan officer, you know, I think it's been the talk at many conferences and think pieces, like does that role collapse at some point? And does one of them become the equivalent of like a title or a credit fee or, you know, different types of fees that the borrower does not necessarily see they pay for, but they don't necessarily see it. Like you're not picking your appraiser, right? That's a service that the lender is ordering during that process. So does one of them become commoditized? I think that's where folks are kind of coalescing around, but just interested in your thoughts there as well, Julian.
I agree. And that's why I focused on origination servicing and real estate brokerage, mainly because those other services are sort of baked into the first of those three, right? And by the way, it's what helps make originations that has those other services integrated into it help to be more profitable. So you've got that kind of buttoned up already. So for me, it's that third one, real estate brokerage. Do lender shops that have real estate brokerage need to make money on all three, or need to make full boat on all three? Or is maybe real estate brokerage that last one where it's like, hey, we're dominating originations and servicing, let's do the other one for a deep discount. And really, that is disruptive. And we all talked about disruption until such time as things have looked the same for many years in this innovation era that we've been in. But that would be revolutionary, is like, hey, guess what? We don't need to make 6%. We're going to do it for one, because we just want to keep the customer. That's our end goal. That's one-stop shop, like in a visionary way, in the basis points view.
So Julian, I think now would be a good moment perhaps to pivot, because I know you have some questions you actually want to ask Mike. So take it away.
Would love to. Yeah. So I've got three, and I greatly appreciate Optimal Blue letting me flip the script, being both hosted and being able to ask a couple questions too, because y'all are up to so many interesting things. So I want to ask three quick questions. First, like your CEO, Joe Terrell, he's an ecosystem company leader, having played a key role in the ICE ecosystem strategy. At Ellie, it was about modernizing, enhancing core product across all loan types, borrower profiles, then expanding into other areas of originations, eventually servicing to become what that org is today. Is it a similar theme at Optimal Blue today? And like, what's it like on the inside? Is, you know, what's the firm pushing for strategically this year, next year?
Appreciate that question. You know, Joe has set like the standard with what he did with the ICE, you know, Ellie Mae network. And, you know, Optimal Blue has a deep, robust partner network and has for a number of years, but we are trying to take it to the next level. And so some of the things that we're thinking about doing, and this directly, I think, will relate to additional value to users and loan officers and borrowers, is we're looking at ways to pull in other component parts of what I would call like the deal structuring process. So I mentioned earlier that like we talked about like how I used a bridge loan in a recent transaction. Going through that was like a semi mind altering experience for me. And even someone who like lives and breathes this stuff, actually going through it yourself, like can really change your perspective. And there are just so many different component parts of the transaction that need to be considered when you're looking at this as like as an economics problem for a borrower, right? So I'll never not say that rates not the most important thing. I work in the rate business. Rates are the most important thing, in my opinion. But there are a bunch of other things, like how to leverage the equity in your home. Are there specific programs that could help you buy a home that are different than just the agency-backed mortgage, right? Are there things that need to be considered, like potential impact of different taxes? Homeowners insurance, in the news all the time right now. When I went through the process, and again, I think I consider myself a fairly savvy person, I just said, okay, keep the homeowner's insurance because I have other things with that provider. I didn't shop it. I didn't look around. I could have optimized that a little bit more. And there's these component parts that could help you structure the deal. And so we've been exploring different partnership opportunities with folks to continue to kind of help that, to set up our loan officers with the ability to structure these deals. And about June, right around the time that we were at the gathering together, we actually released a new product in partnership with one of our partners called Capture for Originators. That's meant to help loan officers actually do refis with like a two-click process. And actually it culminates with a stylized presentation to the borrower. So we're trying to leverage the different parts of our partnership network to keep running towards these goals that we have, right? The goal of trying to make the loan officer more efficient, right? To actually leverage the powerful rate generation that we have and get it further up that like funnel, if that makes sense. Not just at the point of like, hey, I have a home and I need the rate, but at the point of thought, right? You're thinking about getting a home. Well, you need to be considering all these other things, such as not just the rate, but the different products, the combination of how you leverage your equity and so on. So that's kind of how we're layering in the partnership network with the long-term goals here at Optimal Blue.
Yeah. And y'all, again, as an ecosystem company, have one of the biggest partner networks out there, because everybody has to be integrated in some way to OB. So it's interesting. All right. Second, related, because these are all related to team members, if you will. So Aaron Wester was recently appointed to Chief Product Officer. As Olivia said, we had the privilege of hosting a few members of the team, including Aaron, on stages over the past couple of years. So what are the primary product roadmap priorities right now? If you could name it, is there anything you can talk about from PPE through secondary? Because again, OB runs that entire spectrum. And you did just announce something recently about locking directly with investors, which seems small, but it's frankly not small. It's like a huge deal. So maybe you could start with that one.
Yeah, I'll start with that one and build our way up to the overall strategy. Honestly, this is like the white whale of PPEs in terms of like product enhancements. In the current world today, you lock a loan typically within an LOS through the PPE, like the PPE is framed into the LOS. You say, hey, I want to lock my loan with this investor, or I'm locking it internally with my own proprietary pricing. But if you're locking it with an investor, what typically happens is a PPE writes that record back to the LOS, and then a human at the lender has to then go to an investor's website, take a file from the LOS, and then lock it through their portal to create the record for the investor. That's when you get your commitment number, and that's how you're able to match things together, right? Lender has this loan number and this commitment number. Investor has this loan number and this commitment number. Everybody's good. What we've released with our direct lock feature is when you click that button within the PPE, it not only creates that record in the lender's LOS, it's also creating that record immediately on the investor side as well. So no human has to do anything. It's a direct click and you've done everything you need to do. And I think for the investor community, it's a huge improvement, because no longer you're not exposed to any interest rate risk as you're waiting for people to then take applications and move files physically, you know, on different websites. It immediately happens. So if Mike Vogue Mortgage is buying a loan and Julian locks it within the PPE, I see that loan immediately. I'm able to adjust my risk position and then move on with my day. I'm not waiting, right? Oh my God, let's say if the Fed changes rates, that could be extreme market move risk that you're exposed to, and that's gone. And so it kind of like feeds into this larger product strategy that we have of the feedback loop. So this is something I think folks don't necessarily think about a lot, but there is a feedback loop between the primary and secondary markets. So the PPE is more of that primary market exposure. And then the secondary market, the hedging and trading side is the secondary market. And there's this feedback loop. And the feedback loop happens when you're executing loan sales, when you know how a hedge is effective or not, when you see hedge cost or extensions or renegotiations associated with the loans, you know the profitability at the point of the loan sale. Well, that should impact how you price in the front end, right? If you know investor XYZ is paying 25 extra basis points for this type of loan, well, tomorrow when you publish your pricing, that should be inclusive of that. And we believe this is a part of this, right? You're taking out operational costs on a direct lock. You're reducing risk there as well. And it's helping tighten the feedback loop. So in terms of our general strategy, you're going to see more convergence between our flagship products of the PPE and Encompass Edge, our hedging system, all under the guise of bringing more of that secondary profit more to the front end and quicker, so that folks can make decisions much faster, especially volatility has gone down a little bit, but this year has been a fairly volatile year from a rate perspective.
Yeah. And y'all have heard me say this about your firm before, like first consumer quote through secondary trade, that's just a little bit harder than it looks to execute on all of that, because oftentimes when people think of the space that you play in, like of course PPE comes to mind, but the full secondary spectrum isn't always first of mind for a lot of people, especially on the origination side. So yeah, that's why that is such a big deal. And I appreciate you addressing that. I'm gonna expand on that while I ask my third question. But before I do, just one teaser about Erin herself. Optimal Blue has just, the Basis Point works with LendingTree on their summit that they host for all their customers every November. And that is ground zero of the direct lending community, speed to customer, price first approach. And so Optimal Blue is actually sponsoring the Innovation Challenge, where we do 9 demos at that conference. And Erin is actually going to be joining as a judge of that Innovation Challenge. So I just want to let all of your audience know that as well. That's exciting for us and LendingTree as well. So, but last question, if you don't mind, it's about you. So also likewise, just recently you were appointed to the Chief Strategy Officer. So related to these first two questions, like I just wanted to know, like you and I have talked a little bit about it, but in a public forum like this, like what's the mandate for your role? You know, if we connect your role to this company vision that you've talked about, part two of that question, like what's your mandate And is it like, is it build, buy, partner? Are you acquisitive, or are you just building everything in-house with Aaron and team? How's it, or is it all three? Is it all of the above?
Yeah, to cut to the point, it's all the above. So the main thing that I kind of oversee in the new role is the 3 to 5 year vision of the company. So what do we want to be when we grow up? And that 3 to 5 year vision eventually becomes the 1 to 2 year product roadmap. So Aaron and I are very tightly aligned on like what we want the company to be. And then there's other aspects that I run through that, our partnership network, our data business. And then we're also starting up an M&A business as well as part of Constellation. I mentioned some of the things I said earlier from a partnership standpoint, but there's always going to be things that we build. We've been pumping out a ton of new functionality, Direct Lock being one, a lot of AI features as well, but we're also going to be looking to deploy capital. So it depends upon the opportunities that are out there. You know, I mentioned in general that like we're also monitoring like that the real estate trends that are out there because our previous conversation, rate and the home buying market, like they go hand in hand in terms of that affordability.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And then when I mentioned that primary, secondary market, there is other component parts of the capital markets ecosystem that impact what happens in the mortgage secondary market. There's other market participants that view our secondary mortgage market as their primary mortgage market. So there's other component parts, whether it's how loans are eventually turned into MBS securitizations, how they're chopped up even further into collateralized mortgage obligations, or they become RMBS or PLS loans, which we've seen more of these non-agency offerings out there recently. There's things that happen with servicing, right? We're exploring and monitoring all those different downstream component parts because they do impact secondary profitability. And we view it as a larger extension of that feedback loop. So like to boil it down, it's all about the feedback loop, right? It's all about how lenders are getting that feedback from however their loans are executing in different iterations of the secondary market and how that powers their profitability on the front end. And there might be things that seem operational, like the Direct Lock feature seems operational in some ways, but operations is a component part of cost that we're trying to drive down as part of this feedback loop, right? The longer it takes to lock a loan, the longer it takes to underwrite a loan, there's more hedge cost associated with that, right? The longer to hedge something, there's more of a time value trade-off there you have to be cognizant of. So that's our kind of like underlying ethos and strategy is feedback loop, feedback loop, feedback loop, but we're going to do it any way possible, whether that's build, buy, or partner.
My analogy for that one would be it's exactly the same as the originations process. If it's cleaner up front, it's cleaner on the back at QC, post-close, everything, right? So I think that analogy works great. And I thank you, Olivia, for letting me take the host mic for just a moment. And I would just close that by saying, hey, fintech community, hear what Mike just said, rewind it, listen to it again. And you probably want to talk to Mike now that you know what he's actually up to in his new role.
Appreciate that, Jillian.
We'll be sure to include all of Mike's contact info in the show notes if you're not already connected with him. But Jillian, we can't let you go until we ask you what we call our bonus question. So as you likely know, Optimal Blue's mission, which Mike touched on many times in his last answer, is to help lenders maximize their profitability. So with that in mind, our question to you is, what is one thing in your opinion that you think lenders should be doing in today's market to maximize their profitability?
I'm going to answer that one because, it can be tech, it can be customer relationships, et cetera, but I'm going to answer it in a tech context because the Basis Point believes second half of 25 and 26 are going to be the start of the ROI phase of the fintech era. The first 10, 12 years of the fintech era was modernization, going from paper to digital. Now we're getting to the ROI phase, and AI is a big, big part of that, right? So for retail shops, the advice would be like place ROI from AI focus on underwriting and processing. Why? Because that's 21% of today's 12,579 costs per loan. And AI can move the needle most here by just what we just said, getting quality files up front, which reduces that check the checkers path from originations through post-close, right? For direct shops, cost per lead is always a goal for profitability. And in this tough part of the cycle, the direct shops have been doing really well, pushing lead costs down, especially with the aggregators. But can they keep that cost down when rates drop and aggregators have more leverage? it's going to get harder. So how in a direct shop do you get to that profitability? I think that their focus actually would be on using AI to make LOs faster. So in retail shops, using AI to make underwriting and processing more efficient. In direct shops, it's using it to make LOs faster and more efficient. What Jarvis is to Tony Stark, sales support AI should be to direct lender LOs. So they have accurate pricing. And as Mike said, accurate pricing and guidelines. So they're quoting deals that close. And then they have all the direct to source data up front for faster pre-approvals. So I think that matters because direct lenders are about to have a massive run and that's what they need to work on most. And then final note on this, for all lenders that service, having smarter servicing that can retain more than 24% of refis and get closer to these category leadership levels of like 83% retention, that means your customer acquisition cost goes away in the form of retention, and that's a form of profitability.
Yeah, and I got to build on that. Like I think everybody right now is looking for ways to come up with creative solutions to not have to have like this accordion model staffing, right? So whether it's at origination, at sales, in cap markets, in servicing, historically it's been scale up with people, scale down when things are bad. But if you're able to invest in this technology and give you that flexibility of scale, so that you know, the people that you have today could do incrementally more, originations or do more applications, process more loans, et cetera. That's going to set up the next winners, in my opinion. So I had to jump in there at the end.
For sure. Yeah.
I was going to say, Julian, I think Mike liked your answer to the bonus questions.
Nice.
Julian, thank you again so much for joining us. You are welcome back anytime, and we will see you on the conference circuit.
For sure. Would love to come back. Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
Thanks, Julian.
Is your technology vendor selling real solutions or just the idea of them? Too often, companies pitch big returns, offer free trials, and promise seamless automation, only to reveal during implementation that the tech doesn't actually exist. At Optimal Blue, we take a different approach. Our AI-powered automation is already live, already delivering, and already saving lenders real dollars. We show you exactly where the ROI comes from and how it reduces risk. No vague timelines, just proven technology that's working in production today. AI at Optimal Blue isn't just about delivering software. It's about empowering lenders to make smarter decisions, operate more efficiently, and stay ahead of the curve. Built around real capital markets challenges, informed by direct engagement with thousands of clients, and focused on delivering measurable value at no additional cost to clients. While others talk about AI, we're delivering it. Innovation that delivers for your bottom line. Learn more at optimalblue.com.